Well, happy holidays.
Season's greetings.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Now, I think I said this last year, and I'll say it again, and maybe I'll say it next year. Hopefully. Before I start this thing about the war on Christmas, and just for some ammunition on your part, if you get confronted with that, that the war on Christmas is actually an effort to maintain a belief system over a conquered territory. Because before the Christmas story came, there were other stories and other ways of life and other peoples and other belief systems that existed. And then came this group of people with the new story and said, now our story is true and your story is no longer true. So the war on Christmas is really about an insurgency of pushing back and claiming back territory that was once the people who are pushing back against. So is that really a war or not? I don't know. But we're insurgents. It's odd, isn't it? As I talk about happy holidays today, I'd like us to keep two things in mind. And the first thing is that faith traditions, regardless of your faith traditions in general, have a myth and have a story. And that story has a positive, I think, function and sometimes a negative function. The positive function of a faith story, it is to connect us to the values that are ancient, that are old, that have worked and have been in our history, and that we can maintain. And so we know our faith tradition, and it helps protect our minds and it helps protect our imaginations from propaganda, from con artistry, from doctrines that move and toss back and forth by different winds. And our faith tradition can anchor us in time and place. And our faith tradition can give us a community of belonging. And those are the positive things about a faith tradition. A negative thing about a faith tradition is if it gets so solidified in my mind and I think that my faith tradition is more than just a story, more than just a myth, more than just guiding principles and guiding values in this life, but my faith tradition is absolutely true, then it becomes a problem. Because then I'll become imperialistic with my faith tradition. As the Sufi scholar Henry Corbin says, that we all have that divine spark within us and we need to contribute that divine spark into the community, and that creates a dialogue of love and compassion when there's tolerance for the expression of all the uniquenesses of that divine spark within us, but that when one person's divine spark begins to dominate others, we indeed have spiritual imperialism. The other thought that I'd like to keep in mind is that when your faith tradition, or that when your myth, your story, or your people's way of life becomes the dominant one in culture, becomes the one in which governing structures are structured by, then indeed we find out the deeper structure of who that group of people, who they are. So keep that in mind. When your faith tradition, or when a person's faith tradition or values or systems of thought becomes the dominant one and begins to govern a culture, we really see the truth of who those people are or who we are as a people. And I thought I would talk about four traditions. First, talk about the solstice, and then three other traditions when we say happy holidays may come to our mind. And the first one is the solstice, and what I like about this way of layering understanding the happy holidays, if we can layer it chronologically, we can see what other traditions have adopted from other traditions. So it's not like we have this tradition and we read it back and impose it upon traditions. We try to go back in history and walk history up, and that way we can see the threads that other traditions have adopted and put in their message of happy holidays. And in the solstice way of understanding, a pagan way of understanding these happy holidays, well, certainly is not just earthbound and sunbound. But when I first thought about it, I thought, well, what it must do is it marks a sense of hope that the longer days are coming and that winter's going to end and that the spring will soon be here and wonderful things are on their way, and it's been hard up to this point. And so that was my assumption. You know, that sounded good as things we celebrate. But then upon reading, the solstice marked the day that we are preparing for the most difficult times of winter. It was a day or a week or a time in which a lot of the animals were slaughtered for meat because there wasn't going to be enough food to feed them through the winter. And it was a day that marked, and they used to call it the season of famine. It was a day that marked some of us weren't going to make it through the solstice day. And it was also a day when the wines and alcohol fermented at this time, and so there was big parties and festivals. So there was parties and festivals and getting drunk and whatever that meant for those people as they slaughtered calves and had big festivals. And because it was the longest day, they had big bonfires. And it was very much connected to the movement of the earth, and their beliefs were very, very real. But the truth of life that I got out of that was that, yes, that there was hope, and yes, they came together, and it was a celebration, there was communities, there was sense of belonging, but as life is, that's not all life is. They were preparing for something very difficult that was about to come upon them, and that was the deep part of winter. So in a way, when we get together for the solstice holidays, and we come together and we celebrate here in Florida, I think it's cold, so I'm getting ready for the cold, right? And I found myself today, and I had to turn the shower on and just standing there, and I thought, oh, this is warm. This is what warm is. So I said, yeah. So I stopped, and then I had to get going and get moving in order to get here. But I suspect up north, as a family member's wondering whether the pipes went into the house that carry the oil. I can remember living in a trailer when I was younger in Denver and making sure the lines were plugged in, the electric heater lines were plugged in that go around the pipes. I'm getting closer to the solstice because we're getting prepared for something that could happen. And what the solstice meant was that we had already been involved in a preparation for the season, and that there was a preparation that occurred. And I thought, in that life, there's this hopeful thing. The days are going to get longer. The spring is going to come. And I thought, now I know why we celebrate spring so much. Because if you made it, it was a celebration of life. And in the midst of rebirth and life and death and rebirth come out. Not because of some abstract religious thought, but because of the reality of the harsh winters that we had to participate in. So that made sense to me. Here comes the rebirth. Here comes the making it through the difficult times. Here comes deliverance from being captive, deliverance from hell, so to speak. And I'm reminded of a young boy who came up on a pulpit just before the service and came on my lap with a little car. And I was reminded of a story of teaching my son to play chess and watching another father teach his child to play chess. And so, you know, I don't know if you play chess, you know, the pieces are separated and they each have individual orderly moves that you have to make. And that, so what I did was we put all the pieces in a corner and had triangled pieces, and we had knights and bishops that could fly and castles that could jump over pieces and kings and queens that could do everything. And, you know, and naturally, when his piece flew over all my pieces, they could take three or four at a time, right? And so then it was my turn. I moved correctly. Right, we did this for a long time, and the other, watching the other two people do the same process, it was, no, you have to do it this way, and it has to be moved this way. Well, I can still play chess with my son today, but the other person does no longer plays chess today. You know, the same thing happened. I was watching people with golf and parents teaching their kids to play golf. So I always have the fantasy that when children come up here and can play around, we're nurturing future ministers. That's my thought. That when children come up here and talk, they're not going to be anxious about talking in front of people, and they're going to be able to express themselves. When they can come up here and look out and see and know what happens under here, that they feel free to imagine themselves doing that one day. And we don't know what we're nurturing when that happens. We just don't know, right? And so the car might have been, you know, but so there's something about life in that, in a participation in community in life. The next holiday that I want to talk about is Kwanzaa. Now, you may ask, now wait a minute, Kwanzaa was 1965. You know, how can that be second to solstice? Why isn't Hanukkah there? You know, why isn't Christmas there? You know, Kwanzaa has its roots. I mean, it's called first fruits. It has its roots in ancient Egypt. And if you can remember the sermons when we talked about the Dark Mother and the sermons about what it means to have some understanding of what pre-patriarchal culture was in the Dark Mother. And we learned that the value system in that was cooperation, was community, was kindness, was compassion, was collective working together, and it was a strong sense on equality. And of course, we could be projecting that back on, but the evidence we have says something like that. As maybe a romantic or idealist, I want to believe it, so that helps me. that helps me to believe it, that before we have this oppressive structure, that human beings could operate cooperatively, and we certainly have stories of peoples operating cooperatively in life and moving through time. And so I like, in my reading of Kwanzaa, there are some roots that would go back that far. And so I'm going to say second Kwanzaa. And that when I read through the principles of Kwanzaa, and I thought I'd just go through them here. There are seven principles in Kwanzaa. And I didn't have time to do this, and maybe you can do this, and I'm sure during the course of the year I'm already thinking about doing it, is taking the seven principles of Kwanzaa and just comparing and contrasting them to the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism to see if there's any similarities. And if you remember or have read that in 1965, at the birthplace of this Kwanzaa or the rebirth of this value system that may have been oppressed, in 1965, this country was in turmoil. And the African-American community was really in turmoil. And the African-American community was beginning to feel its voice, was beginning to speak. And the oppressive community, if you remember seeing any scenes of fire hoses, of German shepherds and dogs, the oppressive community that had a group of people in their place had some feelings about this community gaining its voice. And I don't remember, you remember the Olympics, Black Power. I mean, things were moving at that particular point, and people were claiming, and African Americans were claiming a place in this culture, and that met with a lot of resistance. So I thought I would read the principles. The first principle is a commitment to the idea of togetherness, for without unity there is neither family nor community. And open discussions of family problems and their probable solutions are very important. When I first read that, I thought, is this guy a therapist? Because in dysfunctional families, they're usually a closed system. You don't talk about problems. There's secretiveness. There's secrets over here. There's subgrouping going on over here. We don't want to tell the truth because we'll get yelled at. We don't want to tell the truth because it could break up the family and all. The very first principle in unity, the very first principle, is an open system. We're going to talk about our problems. And if you remember at the same time in the 60s, or if you don't, I'll tell you, Virginia Satir was developing family systems therapy. And what she discovered in looking at the family systems in this country was the secretiveness. And so here comes a principle, not only for the African-American community, but for all of us to grab hold of and to understand. The second principle is self-determination. And the self-determination speaks to, we must have our own story, our own faith heritage, and we must have it in our mind and we must have it clearly, because if we don't, somebody else will determine how we're going to live. Somebody else will determine how I'm going to spend my life and what I'm going to dedicate my life to. So here comes this principle. It says, do not allow the dominant culture to colonize your mind to determine who you are going to be. The second principle is self-determination. The second principle is a commitment to building our lives in the image of our interest. And if we as a people are to achieve our goals, we must take the responsibility for that achievement upon ourselves. For self-determination is the essence of freedom. This day calls for a reaffirmation of our commitment to Black America's struggle to build a more meaningful and fulfilling life. A lot of people had trouble with that. Makes sense to me. Third principle, collective work and responsibility. The third principle encourages, again, here comes the therapist. The third principle encourages self-criticism, personal evaluation, as it relates to the common good of family and community. When you think about that value, self-criticism, self-evaluation, how the decisions that you make, how you react in community, in your life, how that relates to your family and to your community. So when I'm on the board of directors of a corporation or of a nonprofit organization and I'm making a decision, this principle means I have to consider all the families that this decision is going to have an impact on. And I got to thinking about our culture right now. We can't even get health care in a suitable form when 58 to 60-some percent of the American people have said, we at least want these words. We don't know what public option means because it gets pretty convoluted. We at least want those words in this bill. We've said that. We kind of said, okay, if you extend Medicare, we'll go for that. So we go for that. So we go for that. Then we don't even get that. This principle says every decision you make, how does it affect the lives and the community of the rest of the people in the realm of who you are and your nation? Maybe we ought to send a copy of this to our representatives. Cooperative economics. The fourth principle. Out of a fundamental concepts of African communal living comes the fourth principle of Kwanzaa. In a community or family, or nation. Now don't leave here and call me communist or socialist. Right? Well, you can. You know, I realize that one church called me a communist after some sermon that probably quoted Marx. But anyway, they called me a communist, and I had just finished reading where Theodore Parker and the abolitionists were called communist. I said, I finally made it. All right. All right. I'm finally a Unitarian Universalist. You know, I'm getting labeled the same names as our faith ancestors. In a community or a family, wealth and resources should be shared. Should be shared. The fifth principle is reviewing our purpose for living. Each family member should examine his or her ability to put his or her skill or talent in the service of the family and community at large, not just for self, but for the family at large, not just for self. The next sixth principle relates to building and developing our creative potential. It involves both aesthetic and material creations. It is essential that creativity be encouraged in all aspects of African American culture. It is through new ideas that we achieve higher levels of living and greater appreciation for this life. Now, as Unitarian Universalists, we have some affinity or some understanding of that. If you remember, or if you don't, in our history, with Francis David, was working his way through Lutheranism, through Calvinism, to Unitarianism, and accepting new thoughts in his mind, finally got to the point where he said that the adoration of Christ as a form and as an idea and as a concept actually prohibits entering to an awareness of the fullness of God. You can use the story of Jesus, you can use the story of Christ to get you to the doorway, but when you enter into that experience of God, you have to let all things go. A new thought, a creative thought. Well, he was thrown in prison and put on trial for that thought. So we have some sense that newness, what these principles are calling for in Kwanzaa, is not going to necessarily find itself welcomed when that's not the dominant belief system. The seventh principle is on faith, but the faith is belief in ourselves as individuals and as a people. Now that's a holiday I can celebrate. Those are principles that I can celebrate. Time is short, so we're going to move to Hanukkah and Christmas. Briefly, Hanukkah. You hear a lot about the miracle of the oil lasting 7 days. It was only enough oil to last one day. But Hanukkah was about the rededication of the temple and to try to have empathy for the creation and development of Hanukkah, we may go something like this. How important is it for us to light the chalice? How important is it for us to come here this morning and have this conversation that is affirming of some principles and critical of other principles? How important is it as an expression of our faith to be here, to see different symbols, kind of covered up by chairs, of different faith traditions as you see them over there? How important is it for us to read the seven principles and believe in the seven principles and have a space in which you can actualize and work toward expressing the seven principles? These are important to us. If a group of people came to our church and had buses out there and said, from now on, the way you worship, the way you understand Unitarian Universalism is no longer legal. And if you choose to do that, you will be put to death. And you will not be able to light that chalice. You will not be able to read the seven principles and take us out on the bus and drive us off our property and say, we now own your property. How would you feel? How would you feel? That's exactly what happened to the Jews in 174 BCE. No, your faith is outlawed. You cannot go into your temple. You cannot light. You cannot do your rituals. You cannot do any of that anymore. And in fact, people moved in and had other worships and polluted and defiled the very opposite in their church. And so then, I don't know if you know the story, Judas Maccabee, his family got together after 8 years, revolted, came back, cleared the temple out, came in, and had a service, and for the first time in 8 years, in that temple, in that building, they were able to come in and light their chalice. That's Hanukkah. And the reason why the oil is important is the only oil that they had was oil that was contaminated by that previous group, and it took 8 days to make pure oil, and they only had enough pure oil for one day. So they lit the candle, and that candle lasted for 8 days till they could take the pure oil that they were making and bring it in and begin to use that. If we forget the first part of the story, it won't have as much meaning to us. But that story was about oppression. That story was about outlawing a faith tradition. And it was about a people strong enough in their faith tradition to come back and to reclaim their territory, to reclaim their temple, and to come back again as a people after their people were killed, hurt, and murdered. Come back again and light their chalice. That's Hanukkah. To understand Hanukkah. I must have thought I had 2 hours for this sermon. Christmas. Hey, mostly Unitarian Universalists, we're going to go with the happy holidays because we're going to be inclusive. And appropriately so. And some of us might be able to say Merry Christmas, but the agnostics, atheists, Jewish, Hindu, you know, maybe not. You know. But I'm going to say, wait a minute, let's slow down on that. What is happening on Christmas is certainly a faith tradition, say Lutherans, Calvinists, Protestants, Catholics, they're not really celebrating the birth of Jesus and the life and death of Jesus objectively. They can't be. What they're celebrating is their faith ancestors' interpretation of that event. That's what they're celebrating. So you have some who say, well, you don't understand Christmas like we understand Christmas, and so forth, and that kind of argument. And so it is actually different. They're celebrating an interpretation of a story and of an event. Some of them are closer to the truth and some of them are further from the truth. Some of them stories just happen to match the values of imperialistic empires, and some stories of Christianity do not match imperialistic empires. And this also goes back to the point when your group's thoughts are governing the system. What is the outcome? I happen to think that the faith ancestors and the Unitarian Universalist interpretation of the birth, life, death, and continuation of the Spirit of Jesus is closer to the truth than anybody else's, for a matter of fact. And one of my reasons for that is, and when I try to understand Christianity as cleanly as possible, is that the core of Christianity is an act of love. Care, service toward others. And so there was a town in 1560 for 80 years, Krakow, Poland, that was dominated by Unitarian thought. It did exist. And this is the commentary of a visitor who visited that town. Here's what he had to say about that town that was dominated by Unitarian values and thoughts. A British visitor reported to what he saw after visiting Krakow, a town in Little Poland, where the heresy of Socinianism, that's us, flourishes greatly. Right? The heresy is tolerance of belief in Unitarian, not Trinitarian. He felt as though he had been transported into another world. Now, those who have been persecuted or those who know territorial issues and you walk across a street and you're in somebody else's territory, you know the feeling of walking into another world. Sometimes you don't feel safe. So this is what this guy said. I have been transported into another world. For whereas elsewhere all was filled with wars and turmoil and persecution, religious wars, horrible things. Here, where the Unitarian values dominated and governed the town, there was all quiet. Men were calm and modest in their behavior, so that you might think them angels, although they were spirited in debate and expert in language. That's who we are when we govern. That's who we are. The most brilliant period of the Polish Brethren, and this is why they had problems. During this period of time, they got a printing press going, and they wrote their treaties and wrote their thoughts, the languages that they debated. They translated it in Polish and Latin and Dutch and English and German, and sent it out all over Europe. They were a problem because they were, it's a curious statement, the Protestant and Catholic reaction termed freedom of conscience, which is these treaties they were sending about, and tolerance propagated by the Socinians as that Socinian dogma, the most dangerous dogmas of all the Socinian sect. The very heart of who we are as a people is the most dangerous value to other peoples who want to dominate. That's who we are. So as Unitarian Universalists translate and experience the life of Christ, the birth in Jesus, because that's where their values came from. They were Unitarian Christians. As they interpret the birth of Jesus, when they actualize it in adult behavior, the outside world says, I've been transported to where angels live. So I think today we can say Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. And we can say who we are as a people. We believe in peace. And when we're in power, that is what happens. Peace. And peace to you.